interview with David Trask, former chairman of the Department of History and also director of student affairs at one time, on Friday, April 28th, 1989, at his home in Washington, D.C. We'll start out with the group of questions so that we get you located. Number one.
My name is David F. Trask. I was in the History Department, and I came as an associate professor and later was promoted to full professor. And I served as chairman of that department as well from 1968 to 1974.
What time did you come? What
year? I came in 1966, and I was 37 years old.
Where'd you come from?
I came from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The History Department recruited me. I'd known several members of the department. The person I knew best was Tom Angress, because we had gone to college together at Wesleyan.
And I didn't realize you were a Wesleyan graduate.
Oh, yes.
Well, so am I.
I know that.
You know that, too. All right.
I also knew John Prep. I knew Hugh Cleland. And I knew Stanley Ross.
I see.
So I knew quite a few people, right, more than most people would know in that department, and knew of others. But it was Hugh Cleland was the person who contacted me directly and brought me there. He was, I think, the chair of the search committee.
I see. What was your particular field in American history?
My field was
diplomatic
history,
right,
and military history.
I see. Why did you come?
Well, I had, of course, grew up in the East and was educated in the East, had gone out to the Middle West, but I wanted to return to the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was interested in the region. And Stony Brook seemed attractive because it was a new and growing institution that looked like it was going to be an important place to be.
All right. And you liked the people in the department?
Yes.
Can you be specific about seven in some way? What was your reaction to the institution?
Well, in those days, Stony Brook was advertised as a university center. It's going to be a very important center for advanced research as well as for undergraduate education. And since I was interested in both undergraduate and graduate education, I came there. It was attractive because it was a new place. It seemed possible that there'd be a flexibility to do things there that maybe might not exist elsewhere. Besides, it seemed likely that younger people would be able to do more sooner.
Yes, right. Did the relationship?
There was opportunity. There seemed to be opportunity there,
right,
that was attractive to me.
Did the close relation to New York City have anything to do with it, or the nature of the location on the island have anything to do with it?
Long Island is attractive. New York, I can live without New York City.
Yes.
I just assumed to ship it out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, but Long Island was indeed attractive.
In other words, you didn't need the libraries in the city.
I did, yes. I went into the city regularly. We used to have what was known as a research car.
That's
and
right.
I went all the time. Bernard Semmel and I were maybe the most frequent users of that car. We used to go in there on our Tuesdays and Thursdays.
I see. All right, number eight. When you got there, what was the institution like? Campus, the people, leadership, and spirit.
Incidentally,
this is not a whitewash in any sense.
Oh, I understand.
I want to get the reactions one way or another.
Well, it was a relatively small campus. There were only maybe 3,000 students when I first came, and the faculty was still relatively small. But it was obviously expanding, and it was rough. There was so much construction around, there were a lot of mud. It was certainly not very prepossessing physically, because it was in its early stages. But it was still, nevertheless, it was interesting because practically everybody was new. People were thrown together, had relatively common background, and there was a strong, most people who came were younger people.
You were building, there's no question.
It was a building situation. Yeah.
Right.
So it was I liked the leadership of the campus. I was impressed by Toll and by by Alec Pond and by Sid Gilbert and others who were.
How about Stan?
And Stanley. And they were very different. They had all kinds of different people there.
Right.
But they did seem to work together well, much better than most administrators in my experience.
What about the character of the student body?
Well, it was a kind of an odd student body, and it was, in those days, it was a very heavily New York City student body. Over time, it became more varied, and the representation of Long Island began to send more students in, even from upstate. And of course, the graduate students came from all over the place. But the students were all pretty bright. Mm-hmm. They came with good test scores and backgrounds because Stony Brook were fairly selective at that point. And other factors that caused, I think, some lowering of standards weren't operative then. On the other hand, Stony Brook wasn't attracting leadership type students. They were going elsewhere, maybe to Cornell, upstate. So the absence of leadership was a very obvious thing about the student. Well, after coming from a place like the University of Nebraska, where the very best students in the state as well, where there was open admission, so everybody came. There were all kinds of different leaders and followers. This was largely a group of relatively hardworking but passive students, and fairly good students.
Offhand, what proportion would you say were first generation college?
Gosh, I just have no idea, but I think it was a relatively high number. I think it might have been 30 or 40%, maybe more. But I don't know. But although I believe statistics existed at the time on that particular question, not others.
Okay.
I mean that I heard some statistics to that, I know, but I was interested in the composition of student body. And I remember that there was information available about that.
Okay. What events, persons, experiences stand out? You think?
Well,
you were there when
the most significant experience was the great drug bust and its aftermath. It's the thing that probably the most dramatic. It led to my own temporary service in the student affairs area. An acting vice president for student affairs was a kind of a troubleshooter and a faculty person to fill in for a while and sort of hold back the whole business. But there was surely that event and the circumstances that followed in the student the 3 days.
Oh yes.
What was the
3 days? Was that?
Well, this was a kind of general university, all elements in the university, faculty, students, administration, and even I think the board of trustees and the council, participated in a kind of general review and discussion of where the university was and where it was going, what the direction should it follow. My own impression of the business was that it really didn't lead to so much change, but it sort of gave everybody a chance to blow off a lot of steam and express themselves. The basic direction with regard to student life had been taken. It established a college program, the residential college program. The whole purpose of that program, as I'm sure you recall, was a reaction to the fact that the modern university was such a large and large and complicated place, and also an impersonal place. The complexity, the size, the impersonality. The thought was to try to cut the university down to manageable pieces, to get back to colleges where you would where people get to know each other, where the faculty and the students, where there would be a living and learning situation was the slogan, where you would both live and learn in the college. But the college program never developed at Stony Brook at all well, despite tremendous interest and support for it from the administration.
Why didn't it?
Well, I think there were two reasons. One was the character of the student body. The students, it was hard for them to relate to something like this. But I think that the principal reason for the failure of the college program was the failure of the faculty to support it. What tended to my way of thinking, the least desirable and least effective faculty tended to be attracted to it.
I see.
The better faculty didn't come into it. And this was understandable. People who were coming to Stony Brook were people who really were research scholars. They were people who gave their teaching responsibilities, which were relatively light compared to most places. They worked hard at their teaching, but they didn't want to go beyond that. And only a few of the leading faculty, people who had national standing in their fields, participated in the college.
Can you name names? Max Dresden?
Max was one. He was involved for a while.
What about Homer Goldberg or?
Homer was involved, but only briefly.
I see. Larry DeBoer.
DeBoer came as the director of the program. The colleges were set up about 1966-67. And the original college masters began in the fall of 1967. I was one of those. And then there was a council of masters, of which I became the chairman. And that was a kind of coordinating and planning committee with which particularly Alec Pond worked closely. And of course, student affairs people like Tilly. And that, out of those, that was a kind of institutional framework for deciding where to go. And it was in that context that DeBoer was hired and brought here as the first director of the residential college program. That's how he got.
How did it work out?
Well, not so well. He had certain strengths and certain weaknesses, but he, I think, was kind of confused by Stony Brook, the nature of the faculty, the students. I don't think he ever really came to grips with it, understood the situation. It took a different kind of person. The second person came was Scott Rickard.
Scott Rickard, yes.
And Scott was more,
professional.
He had background. He had been in touch with students. He was more qualified for the job. And there was another fellow named David, who was briefly an interim person, who was one of the staffers David Tilley had been the head of the student affairs.
He'd been dangerous.
That had been really, I think, part of the problem. Of course, we're talking now about up here when there was tremendous struggles over view, ideological struggles over where to go. Tilley represented the very strong anti in loco parentis position. He represented the knock down all the constraints and limits on behavior. There was one group that wanted to keep things as they were. Most people were in some middle ground. That's where the residential college program was really a middle ground intended to attract the moderates, of whom I was one. But there was a lot of tension between the moderates and the radicals, to use the terminology of the day.
Yes.
And Tilley was very suspect by the middle grounders who believed that that he really wasn't really unreliable. He'd lost confidence of practically everybody, ultimately was taken out of that. My appointment as acting vice president for student affairs was part of the process of easing Tilley out of the situation, because there was a widespread feeling that he wasn't executing.
Well, that is part of a picture that I haven't had from anybody else at first hand, really. I didn't get it really from Dave Tilley, because in his recollections, there was no depth, no philosophical analysis of what went on.
Tilley was an empire builder. It was my opinion, and the opinion of a lot of other people, and I think generally shared by the top-level administrators, Bentley, Glass, another person I should have mentioned as an
administrator.
This group, it was their feeling, and I shared that opinion, we could do about twice as much with twice as few people, that it was an overblown empire, that it wasn't doing very much, if it wasn't helping and maybe was hindering in some way the student, the ethos of the student affairs program with Tilley there was really a kind of anti-faculty program. Of course, there was a lot of irritation with the student affairs people on part of the faculty. Some of it unjustified, some of it justified. Some faculty just didn't want to respond to the problems that young people were at. They were really unwilling or unable to recognize that there was a big problem, that you had to do something about it. But what to do about it was the great question. And it was a tremendously interesting and difficult period, very difficult.
Who succeeded you? Do you remember?
It was Scott.
Scott Ricker.
Yes. Then there was after Scott, there was a lady who came, but I don't remember what her name was, and I never had much to do with her. It was later on, at a point when I was...
Elizabeth Wadsworth.
Yes.
Elizabeth Wadsworth, yeah.
When I was active, doing other things, and was on leave, I was gone for two different years, once on a sabbatical, and then another year I was a visiting professor at the Naval War College. And so my connections were all. But I had more or less exhausted my capabilities and utility in this tremendous burst that was associated with the drug thing, with the departure of Tilley, the 3 days business. Sort of a brief incident in the whole episode, though I was there at a particularly critical and difficult time.
Yeah.
And I had had a...
Now let's see if we can pin it down in terms of years. The bust was 68, I think.
Yeah, so it was about February of 68. It was an exam period, January and February of 68. May have been January.
Did you ever see the big brochure with a picture of the knight in a helmet that was gotten out by the police department. Did you ever see that?
I recall seeing that, but I wasn't too happy with the police department. Oh, no. And so with this tremendous display, and what's interesting was that the police officer, his name was Cummings, Sergeant Cummings, with whom I had dealings later on, was convicted, as I understood, of drug dealing and was put away. Do you know that?
No.
Yeah.
It wasn't Bob Cummings.
I don't remember his name.
He wasn't of the Oldfield police.
No. I don't know. This guy was a Suffolk County. He was the head of the narcotics squad.
Oh.
And he's the one that ran the drug bust.
I see.
But later on, it turned out that
it was
a drug dealer. So I was convicted and went to jail.
Well, I've heard and understood that the reason for the bust in the first place was that the Republican Party in Suffolk had suffered PR wounds, let's put it that way, because of the sewer district scandal. And they needed to recoup themselves, and here was a chance.
That was surely an element.
Yes.
Although, of course, there was a problem with drugs on the campus. This surprised me. I really wasn't aware of the drug problem. It hadn't touched me. I was just not, it was something completely outside of my experience. I was really surprised and shocked by this whole business because my college, George Gershwin College, was the only one in, where they went, didn't find any drugs or anything. It may have been just,
an accident.
We did have, I think, a better program there and maybe more attention paid and so on, but I think it was just a matter of accident. I don't think that there was anything peculiar about that. It may just have been the particular mix of students, or maybe the police who came missed.
Remember not.
But in any event, as it wasn't a part of my own experience, and I don't believe it was of other people in the college program very much, except a certain group of faculty people who knew these kids, or maybe were some way involved themselves in the drug culture. But I think that this whole thing kind of surprised and shocked the faculty generally. Tuned in on us, are really aware of this. How widespread this whole business was. So came to me, at least, as a real surprise.
I remember that when we had a problem with one of our employees who burned down a shack.
Oh, yeah.
And I had to go to the county offices in Hopbog. I was talking with some of the officers, and one of them, who was on the narcotic squad,
yeah,
asked me about whether we had any drug problem. I said, not to my knowledge.
Yeah.
He said, well, it's coming out the island from the high schools. And that was around 64 or 5.
It was clear once the whole thing blew open, then the pattern of development became obvious. I always wondered, in later years, about to the extent to which I think this was sort of a surprise to the senior administrators.
Yes,
I don't think that President Toll or Alec Pond or Bentley Glass or Stanley really had much knowledge or feeling or sense of anything like this, you know, that the problem was as extensive as so much of this as there was.
Right.
I think it came as a surprise generally to the administration, though I can't be sure about that. That's something you might want to ask some of those people. To what extent were they cognizant of all this coming? I think it was a considerable surprise to most people on the campus, the faculty and staff. How much the student affairs. This fellow I'm trying to think of is this...
Bybee?
not Bybee. Well, Bybee, I think that those people knew a lot more about this, that didn't talk about it. And I think they should have, and should have done something, should have communicated. I think this was a case where the administration may not, the faculty may not have been well served, because, this is, after all, the group most likely to gain information. And I really had a feeling they did know a lot about it. I think some of those people were, in a way, participants in this.
I'm going to start again. What were your expectations personally when you came to Stony Brook? Where did you see yourself 5 or 10 years from then?
Well, I had traditional training and traditional notions about college. I thought you were supposed to work very hard with the students, that you were supposed to pursue a very energetic program of research and writing, and that you had a collegial responsibility to contribute to the institution. That institutional loyalty seemed important to
curriculum.
People. That's what, but institutional loyalty was, it was really a relatively small group of faculty who felt that
way.
And this had something to do with the sociology of the times, the kind of people who were attracted to Stony Brook and so on. But I didn't think ahead very much, to be honest. I didn't think about where I'd be 10 years from now. I didn't have any kind of a master plan, as I discovered later on. Some people did have this. I knew what my work was. I was highly interested in it. I just did those things. But I realize now that I had a somewhat different perspective on the notion of university life than some did.
There has been quite a change, and I don't know when the change really began in the concept of teaching, in the concept of the role of the faculty member.
Well, the 60s is a good time to study. This was surely a revolutionary period. The thing that happened to more and more faculty thought of the university as a context for a working out what became known as a lifestyle. They saw the university as a context for their own activities rather than as a place where they taught and did research, and where teaching and research became rather secondary in some funny ways. And a lot of these, this attitude, a lot of these people were hand in glove with some, with what I thought was really a relatively undesirable group of people who were in the student affairs office. If I had remained there for long, I surely would have begun to weed it out, to streamline it, to cut the costs of it, to get different people. To look for people who were really committed to the nowadays I think would be thought of as rather old-fashioned notions about the role of the university. I had a middle ground position on the matter of in loco parentis and so forth. I thought that we were too far, that we had been too parental earlier, and that we had broken down. For example, the dorm. I didn't like the idea of mixed, entirely mixed 24-hour dorm. I personally thought there ought to be some mixed dorms, there ought to be a range of options available.
Right, to the students.
I knew a whole lot of female students who didn't want co-ed dorms.
Yeah.
They wanted to be able to control their existence, and so on and so forth. What we did was turn from one type, which was too restrictive and unduly controlled, to a completely uncontrolled situation. And I think that it really hurt the students. Of course, we had a big problem there that went away, namely the lack of dormitory space, you remember.
Yeah.
what was called tripling, quadrupling in rooms for two. Three or four students would be in a room for two students. But the faculty, most of the faculty were really not committed to the development of the institution as such. They saw the institution as a context for working out their own professional careers.
Well, this is a kind of individualism.
And they didn't see their own achievement as coming through the growth of the institution. They saw the institution as simply as a kind of context for their own activities, a base of operations or whatever.
Well, I think a counteracting force for that sort of thing is the traditions that are slowly built up and the presence on the faculty of individuals who have your point of view and have loyalty to the institution, and also understand that its main purpose is the education of the student body, and are interested in that and have the personal characteristics and abilities to make a contribution. And some of the ones at Stony Brook certainly did, but there were others who, even if they had been told to, wouldn't have known how to do it.
Heavy emphasis on the natural sciences in the early going. Much easier to build science departments than arts departments.
Yes, right.
But I think the people who in those fields, with notable exceptions like Max, say, and others, tended to be more. Their lab was their temple, and so on and so forth. It was their experiments that interested them, and everything else was secondary.
We have a new provost who's an historian.
Yes.
And I've never met him. He's taking Schubel's place July 1st. Schubel was the first-rate chef.
I never met him. Who is the new provost? What is his name?
His name is Edelman, I think.
I have heard of him, and John Pratt told me that he was coming because a place was made for him in the history department.
Oh, really?
Of course, those administrators, as you well know, when they come, they want to have an academic, tenured academic appointment to fall back on.
I never insisted on that, but I came from.
I think that only developed in the 60s. I don't think that happened very much earlier, because most administrators were homegrown and were recruited. But in Stony Brook, and now generally, national searches will be conducted. But in the old days, administrations were very small and were usually recruited from within, with the exception of usually the president, would usually be somebody outside. But otherwise, And Wesley and every administrator I knew until I was there was a homegrown. Mm-hmm. Only later on did begin to bring in people. John Spaeth, for example, comes to mind as an archetypal administrator with a long Wesleyan career.
Well, Wesley now has a new president.
Yes. Chase,
right. Right. Were your activities confined to the Stony Brook campus? That's 13.
No. I had a lot of connections outside of the university. I was active in the faculty governing system. I was what was the name of the outfit? The board that set up that was a representative of the faculty. I was involved in this.
This was the statewide faculty?
No, this was our own little organization. We had
faculty senate?
The Senate existed, but there was a small group, a kind of steering committee, was elected by the faculty. What the dickens was the name of it? I served on this.
What did it do?
it represented the faculty in on issues. It dealt with the administration a lot. It presented faculty points of view to the administration. Worked with the administration. I had gone up to Albany on a good number of occasions for one purpose or another, and had worked. I also, on five or six different occasions, served either as a chairman or a member of a visiting committee to review the history programs.
Where?
At the university, at Buffalo, at Binghamton, Oneonta,
involved with Albany's loss of a PhD program?
No, I wasn't involved in that. I never got the Albany matter. But my advisor in graduate school, Ernest May, was. He was the chairman of the committee from the outside that recommended that.
Is that right?
Yeah. Although I never talked to him about that for reasons of delicacy. But I was not involved in that one, thank goodness. What a mess that was.
I have a son who was an associate professor at Albany now in music. Well, let's see. What about your relations to your own discipline, American Historical Society, or?
I was active in professional associations, the AHA, the Organization of American Historians. And I was one of the founding fathers of the Society for the History of American Foreign Relations.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Which was organized in the middle late 60s. But I was an officer of all of those organizations, a member of editorial boards. So I was quite active in the profession, in professional organizations.
Okay. Did you see people in Albany? Do you have any recollections of any of the individuals who were in the central administration?
I never really dealt with the central administration people. We dealt with the legislature mostly.
Directly?
No. Now there were always state. There were always some people escorting us. And we went through with people from the state central organization. I'm trying to think of one particular fellow. Did you mention Hurd? Did I see his name there?
Norm Hurd. Norman Hurd was the director of the budget under Rockefeller.
He was a person we dealt with on several occasions.
Do you have any picture of him?
Not much. I remember him as a figure, as a name, but there were various assistants to the president who was of the State University. Who was it?
Sam Gould?
Sam Gould came. There was one who preceded him.
Tom Hamilton.
Yeah, Hamilton, Gould.
But Hamilton left before you came.
Yeah, he did. That's right. Gould was the principal figure.
He came in 64.
And we had connections.
And then Ernie Boyer. Do you have any?
Boyer, of course. He's the one who's trying to think
of. I see. Do you have any picture of Boyer and Gould as in their relations with Stony Brook?
I never could really get a sense of this. I thought that President Toll was especially effective in his dealings with the central administration. And I know he did so well, relatively speaking, that it didn't matter. He took care of that, in effect. And faculty people, administrative people went up there. We went up on a relatively disciplined basis to say this or to do that. And there were occasions when we were called up there, when people from other institutions would come. I went up there, it must have been maybe 10 or 12 times.
Is that right?
On one occasion or another.
For our budget?
Sometimes it was budget, sometimes it was questions of policy, graduates, I remember going once on a question of there was a discussion about whether to history programs, and this happened in other disciplines as well, whether Albany would have Latin American studies and Binghamton would have Asian studies, Near Eastern studies. But we didn't like that. We felt that we should have a comprehensive program, and that all the centers should, that it was, that you couldn't really, that the mix, and I can remember, that's an example of kind of very often substantive educational issues.
Yes.
Where the budget was a relatively, the executive vice president very many faculty ever got involved. I don't believe
it. Do you remember Larry Murray at all?
That's not
okay. He was probably before your time. Do you remember Harry Porter?
No, but of course there was a lot of mention of him.
Right.
He was a legendary figure.
Yeah. He was an historian, incidentally.
Yeah. He was obviously a dominating, but very significant presence. So his name was constantly.
I dealt with Harry. He had come in about a year before I joined the system. I joined it as executive dean in the Albany office, detailed down to Stony Brook for a year. 3 years for them to find a successor to Hamilton. Well, let's see. Can you name individuals who did things that were important for the future development of the university as a whole, or some part of it? Talk about individuals.
Well, surely a group of Pond, Gelber, Ross, and
Glass.
That quadrumvirate, they were the key figures that struck me in terms of the building, the tremendous growth of the university. They're the ones who were really the central leaders in the, that is the center of always assuming the direction of President Toll, who was a very strong and tremendously energetic leader, with his finger in everything. Of course, a separate figure was Pellegrino, who was a dynamic, powerful presence. Jammed that medical school for good or ill, and but he a memorable figure. Charismatic figure, surely, in terms of leadership. My recollection of faculty leadership is rather vague. There was so much, leadership moved so rapidly. People rose to prominence and departed rapidly. Nobody stayed in a position of leadership for any great length of time, except with exception of a few people who kind of made a career out of it, like Norman Goodman.
Yes.
There's people like Norman who seem to still do the same sort of thing. That's their life, I guess. We used to call Goodman nor person, good person. We said he had a sexist name and should change his name. But there are a certain group like Norman, who were a kind of a strange breed to me. They were always rather critical and sometimes damagingly critical of the institution and its leadership. Yet they wanted to be close to the leader, wanted to be in on things. And to me, I found it very uncomfortable dealing with this, that particular group of faculty people, because you couldn't. Well, I guess I didn't trust them. I never knew
where they stood,
what they were going to do, and they tended to shift. They had so many antennae out. They didn't have any they catered to this, to whatever happened to be happening in the way of shifts in opinion and so on and so forth. I catered particularly to student whims, which I thought would be responsible. And also, and of course, there was a strong tendency on the part of those people never to let anybody on the faculty get to them left of them politically. So they wanted to be centrists and radicals both. And I didn't like that. I felt that at the time had come, you had to make a choice. So I became increasingly alien. These people were very important in the college program and in other aspects of the development life that seemed important to me. So I got to know them all. But over time, I became more increasingly alienated because I had very different notions about where to go and how to do things in England.
You were a Midwesterner.
I came from Western Pennsylvania and came from the West.
West Pennsylvania. Okay.
And came from
whereabouts in Pennsylvania?
Erie. And I had a very different background than a lot of these people had, and different trainings. So there was I felt, by and large, almost all the people who were trying to influence or help, be helpful, or do something in their student affairs were people that I didn't trust. Be perfectly honest. And over time, it became more and more difficult to work with them because they became less and less, more and more organized. Of course, there were the house radicals like Mike Zweig, and Ted
Goldfarb,
people of this sort, who I thought were, to be perfectly honest, I thought they were thoroughly irresponsible people.
Self-servers.
Whatever, they may have been sincere in their political feeling belief, but I thought they were confused and wrong-headed, and that they hurt rather than helped. They were part of the problem. But of course, they'd say the same thing, I'm sure, about me. But I did find that group very difficult. I thought.